concern has been to try and place some sense of ordering on the complexities of the American religious scene, and I have chosen to do so through the utilization of three topologies. We've looked at two of them. Let me just briefly recapture the main theses of those and then go on to the third one during this hour. The three topologies are paternalism, primitivism, and utopianism. The paternalistic point of view suggests that the American scene in its frontier areas presented a space in which people going without their roots of past occupation degenerate. And what the American wilderness brings out of the individual is the worst side of his character. Thus, it is essential, from this point of view, that those who move onto the American frontier bring with them, in totality, though perhaps in a purified form, the religion and culture from their homeland. And so what we see in denominations like the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Lutherans, and Roman Catholics is the attempt to transplant their former ways onto the frontier. Recreate there, in a better form, the society in which they have been raised. And the object then for each individual is to submit to the traditions of his elders and in this way find the fullness of life. The other point of view, the second point of view rather, primitivism, has a very romantic concept of the American cultural scene and says that it is the Garden of Eden again. And by this to mean that in the purity of the unspoiled wilderness, human beings, sloughing off the cultural traditions of the past, may indeed come and start anew, not being corrupted by traditions, but being possessed only of the Spirit of God. They are able to read the record of God's Word in the New Testament and create first century Christianity on the American scene, create the Golden Age, to live the life as God intended it. The denomination, Disciples of Christ, perhaps summed this up most eloquently when they stated that their movement was to restore the ancient order of things, and to do so by this means that where the Bible speaks, we speak, and where the Bible is silent, we are silent. And along with this point of view went then the American idea of the 19th century, that herein is a society which, if it fulfills its function, will provide the environment wherein each individual will be able to develop every latent potentiality within him. So whether one looks at this religiously or one looks at it in a secular vein, here is the opportunity for the image of God to fully blossom. That's the primitivist. This is found in the in addition to the Disciples of Christ, Methodists and in the Baptists, which become the major Protestant groupings in this country, and then perhaps best of all in a definitely Native American religion, not Indian here I don't mean, but an American religious group, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, who create a religion in this area based on God's revelation to the Western Hemisphere, the Book of Mormon, and God's revelation to the Eastern Hemisphere, the traditional scriptures. Well, in addition then to these two basic formats of the paternalists and the primitivists, I would suggest a third possibility, though on a much, much smaller scale, and that is the utopia, the religious utopias. What I mean by utopianism is that this country provided the environment where one could express his religious convictions without overt persecution from the state. That this was the only land in the 18th, 19th centuries that provided the opportunity for one to believe as he wished, but not only to believe as he wished, but to practice it as he wished. Because one of the basic ideas of the Constitutional Fathers was that this land have religious freedom. Now this idea was not ideologically pure. It was a political necessity. If there were to be a United States, there would have to be religious freedom, because there was no one group that was dominant in 1789. There would have to be freedom. Now, to ensure that there would be freedom, there was worked into the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and into our national legislation, the idea of the separation of church and state. Now, the principle is freedom. The vehicle to ensure that is separation of church and state. I want to underscore that because it seems that in more recent decades, we've rather turned the two around. And we're much more concerned about separation of church and state than we are in religious freedom. But that's just turning around what was the original intent. Well, when we got onto this kick that we were going to ensure religious freedom by separation of church and state, we have before us a double-edged sword. When you separate church and state, it not only means that the church cannot influence the state directly, it also means that the state keeps its hands off the church. And thus, individuals may believe and may practice what they wish. And then, in distinction from Europe, we have in this country, during the 19th century, tremendous vastness of space. And so, if the state lets you practice what you wanted to religiously, but people, societal pressures, invade against this, there was some place you could go, somewhere on the frontier, for you would not be bothered by your neighbors. And here then, you could establish your community, and here then, without societal pressures, you could practice what you wanted to, which was a constitutional right in this country. And so as the frontier moves westward, you often find, before the advent of the railroad, the establishment of a rather large number of utopian communities, which sought in the fertile agricultural lands of the Midwest, particularly, before the railroad came bringing the larger numbers of people, sought to establish communities whereby their distinctive religious ideals could be pursued. Now, what I would like to do this morning is to look at several of these communities, and the specific ones that I have in mind are primarily in the Midwest, but they do have their counterparts as one moves farther west across the nation, and in looking at several of these communities to see what is distinctive about them and as to what their utopianism then sought to underscore. I know some of you are of Swedish background, and this has been brought to my attention when we have looked at Lutheranism. You ask about the Swedish Covenant and the Swedish Methodists and the Swedish Baptists. There was one utopian Swedish community established in the United States in the 1840s. And it is important to the Swedish migration story because it became the location to which the Swedes initially came and then branched out from there into the other parts of the West, into Minnesota, into Nebraska, into the Dakotas. And this is the little community. It never was particularly large, 1,500 at most at any one time, the community of Bishop Hill, which is in west central Illinois, south of the Quad Cities, about 50 miles. It was established in 1846, and it dissolved 14 years later in 1860. It was established by a charismatic prophet by the name of Erik Jensen. Erik Jensen was very much inspired by Methodism that had taken hold in Sweden. And Erik Jensen became convinced that a human being is capable of perfectibility, and that he maintained a Christian is therefore incapable of sin. Now this did not go over particularly well in the Lutheran State Church, which had a rather heavy doctrine of sin. And to have Erik Jensen saying a person should reach that point in his life where he's incapable of sinning. In addition, Erik Jensen stated that the Bible is the only source for the will of God. And he burned publicly all devotional aid that had been prepared by the State Church of Sweden. The Bible alone and perfectibility. Now, if you heard me last time, you're beginning to see some of this primitivism that was so common among the Methodists and the Baptists and the disciples now showing up in this Swedish figure. He was harassed by the Church of Sweden because the Church of Sweden became very disturbed by others in addition to Erik Jensen who were beginning the practice of meeting in little cell groups apart from the state church and developing, as it were, competing religious groupings alongside the state church. The Church of Sweden was totally intolerant of that idea at that point. This is one thing that Erik Jensen taught the Swedish church, to be tolerant to those who are not of that particular faith. But Jensen himself then began to administer communion. And once he began to officiate at communion and disperse the bread and wine himself, he had, in fact, created another church. His followers, who were primarily citizens of wealth, that is, at least moderate wealth, seeing this harassment that was being brought upon them now by the Swedish church, which was exercised to the Swedish government, decided that the only hope for them was to go to America. And anyway, Swedish press began to be filled with the letters and so on of other nations as well as their own about everything was beautiful in America. And so they gathered together their resources, pooled their resources in a form of a communism, and set sail for America. But before they set sail, they sent ahead a scout who tried to find a place where they might live. And they scouted out numerous areas in the American Midwest, but finally decided that the best option for them was in Illinois. And they arrived here in 1846, about 400 of them, in the fall of the year, well after the planting season was past. They didn't have a great deal of food, and so they made dugouts into the side of the ravine. They almost lived like animals in the ground. First winter, half of them, I think, died. But they did survive the winter, and then the next year they started planting and started to develop the colony. And then others came to it. But the religion was the dominant motif. But the religion was centered almost entirely on this charismatic prophet, Erik Jonsson. So that the community was in fact a shadow of him. Well, within 3.5 years, he had become embroiled in a number of conflicts. And so that in 1850, appearing on a court matter in Cambridge, Illinois, Erik Jonsson was shot by the husband of his niece. Jonsson was the guardian for the niece, and when the niece married this man, the man was required to sign the document that he would never take her from the colony against her own will. And the uncle had been able to prevail upon her to never leave, and this aggravated the young husband. He came back and worked out his frustrations and shot the prophet. But the colony was so convinced of the divinity of their founder and prophet that his body lay in state for 3 days in the colony church, because they expected him to rise from the dead on the third day. He did not, and it became evident soon that they would have to bury him, and so they finally did. But this was very disturbing, that he did not rise on the third day. This colony is so much the shadow of this one charismatic leader. Well, in 1850 then, with the death of Erik Jonsson, the colony did not fall apart immediately. But with a corporate leadership, it began to diversify its interests. And it became the trading center for the surrounding countryside. And it came to be, after Erik Jonsson's death, a very favored community in the minds of its neighbors. But they made some bad investments. And the committee that was in charge of the colony didn't really have to report what it did with the colony's finances until after the Depression of 1857, the colony went broke. And so in 1860, it was decided that they would simply dissolve the colony, and each family would be given proportionate to what assets there were, and the experiment terminated. But by 1860, the colony had lost practically all of its religious idealism and was virtually a secular colony. Without any religious bond, I'm suggesting, that was able to supplant the death of the prophet Erik Jonsson, the colony simply became a secular communism, and when that failed because of bad investments, the utopia broke apart and disintegrated. However, even though it broke apart as a commune in 1860, it did not cease its life at that point, because it still became the place to which Swedes came and then fanned out from there. It was the first major Swedish colony, and it remained the first objective for Swedes for quite some time. Then they fanned out across the American Midwest. But here is a utopia, then, that is essentially based on the charismatic qualities of one individual who also had some colonizing ability. But when he was gone, the religious enthusiasm quickly diminished. The committee misappropriated funds. The colony collapsed. Well, other types of colonies that came from Europe are the Amish. Now, the Amish is the most conservative wing of the Mennonite church, which dates from the 16th century, following examples not of Martin Luther in Germany, but more of Ulrich Zwingli in Switzerland. And the Amish colonies are found all over the United States. We probably think of them more in connection with Lancaster County in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Dutch, but you have them across the Midwest. You have a few of them in Kansas, but they stop there. And you do not have the Amish in the Intermountain or in the Great Plains or on the West Coast to any significant extent at all. I don't know if you have any Amish at all. You get out to the Great Plains, you have what is called the Hutterites. You may be familiar with the Hutterites, and you'll find them in the Plain States and up in the Canadian provinces. And there is a subtle difference between an Amishman and a Hutterite, which I will attempt to delineate shortly. The Amish are intensely religiously primitivistic, and so are their Mennonite cousins. And they go back to a movement in Switzerland by Menno Simons and then later by Jacob Ammann, in which they made the point that the Reformation was moving entirely too slowly, that there needed to be a more radical excising of the cultural accretions that had invaded Christianity. And so with the Amish, taking to a more definite extreme, a reform of the church along a purely and simply biblical line, the Amish found themselves at odds with the church authorities, who used the arm of the state to persecute them. So the Amish began to develop communes, partially for religious reasons, partially for psychological and social reasons. A small group of people living a commonly committed life were able in communion, in a commune, to withstand outside pressures. And not only to withstand outside pressures, but themselves to become more committed to their ideal. So this commune separated and strengthened their ideas. But the German authorities sought to break up the simple, plain people by not allowing them to hold on to communes, but forcing them to become exiles into the wildernesses of their native land. This did not destroy the Amish. Breaking them up did not destroy them, but it in fact strengthened them even more than if they had lived in their communes, because being forced to the perimeters of German life, they learned how to farm land that German farmers could not farm. And it's the Amish who were the agricultural experimenters, who introduced forms of fertilization and rotation that made what was generally thought to be unproductive land very productive. Being split into these marginal lands, the Amish then sought to continue their identity by developing a clothes code. They wore a common clothes, and this is still associated with the Pennsylvania Dutch and Amishmen wherever you see them. They wore a certain style of clothes. Not that they thought that they were more holy than anyone else, but that they were the badge of identification. They knew one another because of the clothes that they wore. Finally, they discovered that their only hope was to go to America. And it wasn't they that thought of this idea of leaving Germany. It was somebody like William Penn, who had been given the huge colony of Pennsylvania and needed people to develop it. And so Penn visited and he wrote along the Rhineland, encouraging religious dissidents to come to his new wilderness. And so the Amish did. Well, they got there in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and they discovered that they no longer were living on marginal lands. They had very productive lands. And after a generation or two, they discovered it was hard to be plain when you're prosperous. Their whole way of life seemed to be threatened. by their economic success. So they develop certain rules, and that is, a family can hold only so much land. Enough land to sustain the family, but not so much land as to build up a bank account. So they limited themselves to the amount of land they could hold, and in order to keep themselves plain and simple, they articulated the way the land had to be farmed. Now, this meant that when a family, and they believed in multiplying, when the first son came of age to marry, his father would buy him a farm, give it to him, and there the son would go, and with his bride, live that life. Then when the second child came along, father would have to go buy another little farm. And the third one, go buy another little farm. So that whatever resources the family did accumulate, they went in buying land. And then the last child inherited the home farm, whether it was a boy or a girl, inherited the home farm. And when that child married and settled in the family home, then there was built a lean-to on the house, and that is where the parents moved. And that became called the grandpa house. So that the original parents never left the farm. They provided a farm for each child and then moved into the adjoining grandpa house when the youngest child took over the management of the farm. And in this way, an Amish farmer retires slowly to the grandpa house, where he becomes the babysitter for the family that continues in the house. And so that an Amish family is an extended family. At least three generations will live on the farmstead eventually. But even in the Pennsylvania Dutch Company, country, the farmland finally was gone. And so they had to move west to find more land to establish more Amish colonies so that this way of life be duplicated. And when you get out into the Midwest and you take a look at these Amish communities today, an Amish farm runs around 80 to 100 acres. It is farmed only by manual labor and what a horse can pull. No tractors. Or if they do moderate and allow a tractor, it cannot be a tractor with rubber tires. It has to be a tractor with steel lugs. And a bishop told me the reason for this. If you have a tractor with lugs, you will be so jolted as you farm the field that you will not be tempted to farm any more land than you have to. If you have rubber on your tractor, you will be easy to farm land, and the first thing you know, you'll be going down the road to another half section. And when you do that, you'll be buying more machinery. And pretty soon you'll no longer be yourself, but you'll be a servant of the bank. And you will have lost the simple life of the close association of a man, his horse, and the good earth. So they're plain. They have this simple life. They're close to the soil. The children, they do not have much delinquency because the children all have to work. Now they have a very careful division of labor. The boys work in the fields and the girls work at the house. But that also includes the garden. It's an enormous garden. Now, they allow no adornment within the house. Only pictures on the wall are those you get on calendars, because calendars are utilitarian. So every room in an Amish home will have a calendar with a big picture on it, because they allow no other pictures. They want to keep things simple and keep things plain. They grow all of their own food. Their meat, they don't have freezers because they don't have electricity. So they can their meat. It's very tasty to have canned beef. This is the simple life. Now, along with this, and this is probably what brings them their greatest infamy today, is they're opposed to education. Amish are opposed to any education beyond eighth grade. And they say that eighth grade is all that you need because that will give you the rudimentary ciphering. You'll know a little bit of reading, writing, arithmetic so that you can do business with the outside community. But your real education is what you learn at home from your father. Because an Amishman may only be a farmer. It's the only way of life for them. If one of them grows away to school and becomes a doctor, he's no longer an Amishman. Amish is only land-oriented. So there are agricultural communities, small farms, manual labor, economically self-sufficient, and their education goes only through the eighth grade. Now this has caused a difficulty in a number of states which require a student to go to school until he's, say, 16. However, the Supreme Court has recently decided that education is fundamentally the responsibility of the parents and is not the responsibility of the state. And so the Amish conduct their own schools with uncertified teachers. And their children only go through the eighth grade. Now in Iowa, this is worked out in this fashion, that the governor has stated that if in the Iowa eighth grade examinations, Amish children score as high as the general public school children of the state, then he will see to it that there's no attempt to coerce the Amish because the objective has been reached. And in the last decade, it has only been 1 year that the Amish children have not scored higher than the public school children, even though their teachers have no more than eighth grade educations themselves. But they have developed some of their techniques by taking correspondence courses. So an Amishman says that their school teaches the four R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and respect, and that they have, and that they turn out a better product than the American public school, which doesn't teach respect, but instead teaches competitiveness. And the Amish life is not competitive. It is utopian. That's one way. And because there are a lot of parcels of land in the American Midwest that your large John Deere tractors are never going to be able to place under production, there are always nooks and crannies where Amishmen may go and live their way of life. So here is an example of a utopia that today is increasing rather than declining. They're establishing more and more colonies in marginal lands. But they had a trouble when they came out here in the Great Plains. They tried to live in the Dakotas, Nebraska, and Kansas, and tried to raise wheat. And they discovered that the horses died in the August heat. They couldn't run their little farms out there. So they have been replaced in the Great Plains, Inner Mountain West, by their cousins, the Hutterites. Now the Hutterites, as a variation utopia, but the Hutterites are completely communistic. And they're very successful economically as communist colonies. But the Hutterites say that in our areas of large-scale agriculture, we have to make the best use of the latest techniques And so Hutterites farm large-scale ranches and buy the latest and best machinery. And also, however, run their own Hutterite schools right on the colony. But we'll also have to see to it that some of these go off to mechanic school to learn how to run and operate this machinery. Now, in the Amish society, they are not communists, because every Amish farmer owns his own farm. But in the Hutterite community, it is a corporate ownership. But among the Amish, too, they have an idea of how to take care of disasters. They do not participate in Social Security. They will pay Social Security taxes, but they will receive no benefits. Finally, I think the courts have decided that they ought not to pay the Social Security taxes, since they religiously refuse to receive the benefits. So they take care of their own insurance. If an Amishman's barn burns down, the Amishman must sustain himself one-fourth of the loss, and his neighbors will supply the other three-fourths. And the reason they make the Amishman sustain the one-fourth is that he might be tempted to try and get a new barn. But if he knows he has to pay for one-fourth of it, that temptation won't be so strong. In terms of medicine, the Amish take care of their own. They have to go to a doctor, since no doctor could be an Amishman. So they have to go an outsider. They will go to a chiropractor first. This was raised here the other day. They'll go to a chiropractor first. If that doesn't succeed, then they will seek medical attention. But the neighbors, again, will share the cost. Now, in the Hutterite community, it's different, because it is a commune, so the community sustains all of the cost. That type of thing. Chris, you had a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask if they had any relations with the general public, like recreational, or do they keep entirely to themselves?
Both the Hutterites and the Amish, it's easier for the Hutterite because they sort of live by themselves in these big ranches and are fairly sizable communities. And the Amish, social relations are only within their own group. And so mating occurs only within the own group. And they have this all worked out and what they call the Sunday evening sings. They'll have Sunday evening sings at somebody's farm. All the young people go, and then they do their singing. And then somehow they don't always go home with whom they came. All the kids in the family will come together, and they sort of go home two by two. And of course, it's all down horse and bike, because there are no automobiles. They say the horse knows the way home, so that's how they get home. But it's every Sunday, this is how they do this. All their social relations are within the group. Now, it may be necessary for, say, an Amish girl to work in a nearby town for a while. And for a temporary thing, all right. But not for a long-standing thing. There is relatively little loss. It's the only way of life they know. It is a comfortable way of life. It's a secure way of life. And most Amish children prefer to remain in it. If they go out into the world, quote unquote, they're lost. It's hard to cope with it. They come back home and stay within their group. That type of thing. Yeah?
Are you familiar with the Dooku Boys in Canada?
Not specifically, but this is another one of these German groups somewhat on this pattern. But that is a form of utopianism, then, that is based on an agricultural community of hand labor. And as long as there are marginal lands, there's no reason why the community cannot grow. And as far as the Hutterites are concerned, as long as there ranch lands available, and you find them somewhere in Oregon, there's some large Hutterite communities, and you get into Montana, has some very large ones, the Dakotas have them, and then up into the prairie provinces of Canada. And I think they're also going over into other nations of the Commonwealth, and they're finding areas in which they can develop and pursue their utopian way of life. Now, could you become an Amishman? Anyone can become an Amishman who wants to. Their doors are open. They're not closed. They invite people to come into the community. But there are certain problems. And that is, they're trilingual. And you have to be able to speak not only English, but you have to speak High German, you have to be able to speak Low German. And if you can handle the two German dialects, then you're welcome to join them. They're not missionary-minded, but they're not exclusive in the sense that they will not allow someone else to come in. But you have to be able to handle their languages in order to do so. Another German group that is part of this utopianism that is located only in the state of Iowa, but I just heard a couple weeks ago that they're going to establish another settlement somewhere else. It's a group known as the Amana colonies. And they're probably known across the nation, not for their religion, but for their very successful attempt to cool beer and the development of the nation's largest home refrigeration corporation, the Amana. Freezer Corporation. The Amanas are interesting to me because they are Lutherans. They come out of Lutheran pietism of the late 17th and 18th century. But they have this twist on Lutheranism, a little bit like Erik Jansson in Sweden. Amana believes that God raises up from time to time contemporary prophets. And those prophets then speak the word of God, and what they say becomes part of the scriptural tradition. So that the Amana Bible includes not only the Old and New Testaments, and they use the Luther Bible, but also includes the writings of their prophets. And the prophet can be either a man or a woman. In fact, the last prophet was a woman, Barbara Heinemann, who died about the turn of the century. The Amana colonies, beginning in Germany, did create a commune, except that they are not interested in just one vocation. The Amana colonies represent all the trades, so that they are very much a self-sustaining community. And they developed a castle in Germany, Rottenburg, until they were driven out. And their being driven out was made easy because their prophet, Christian Metz, had a vision from God that they should go to America. And so they went and settled at Ebenezer, hitherto hath the Lord shown us, which was near Buffalo, New York. But when the city of Buffalo encroached upon the Indian reservation, the Seneca land that they had purchased, they tried to find a new place, and they found it out in the rolling hills of Iowa. And they settled out there in the 1850s and built seven villages. And when you come to the Amana colonies in Iowa, you sort of drop back into Germany, because while many of them are farmers, there are no farmsteads. Everybody lives in the village, and they go out and farm the land. So you'll have these long rows, these large fields, and the only housing is centered in these seven specific little villages. But their religion was communistic until 1932, and still retain some of the communistic flavor, but they had no objection to modern conveniences. And so they developed whatever modern technology had to offer them that would be profitable to them. But their greatest distinction from the Hutterites and the Amish is not only in their contemporary prophets, but in their strong like for education. And the Amana colonies want their children to have the best education possible. And in terms of testing, they have the highest ranking school in the state of Iowa. If you're an Amana high school graduate, according to testing, you have the best education that can be obtained in the state. And they send many of their young people on to the university. But they say when their children go to the university, they're immediately under disciplinary problems because they have no concept of private property. And they can't keep off people's lands in Iowa City. It's the kind of trouble they create. They've never been raised in the sense of private property. But they make good students, and then they come back. Now they come back to Amana because, again, here's a way of life that they appreciate. Here's security. If they want a farm, there's land to be farmed for the colony. If they're artistic, they can work in woodworking, in woolens. The crafts are there. If they're mechanically inclined, they can work in the refrigeration factory, the Amana freezers. Most of their young people do come back to the colony. It is a utopia. And it's still going. It's succeeding. And as I said just a couple weeks ago, I understand that they're going to establish another set of colonies somewhere. I never heard exactly where it was going to be. Religion is still a vital part of the Amana colonies. And it's a different type of Lutheranism. Not a doctrinal, it's a much more mystical form of the faith. The preacher is also the school superintendent. They have no clergy. And he, talking to him once, he described how he prepared his Easter sermon. And that is, he got up before dawn, and it was a very hazy day, and went and sat on the highest hill in Amana, and watched the sunrise, and thought of what this meant to him. And then he went back to his congregation at 10:30 in the morning, and discussed with them his mystical experiences on the hill as he watched the sun arise on Easter morning. That, to him, was his Christian faith. Well, there are other of these colonies, and there have been some that have been started that were purposely not religious. And one of these that we have in the Midwest that finally ended up in Cloverdale, California, which I think is up in the Napa Valley, is a group called the Icarians. They're French. French idealists who tried to combat the rising industrialism in the 19th century in France and almost had a chance to try out their colonization as a result of the French Revolution of 1848 when their leader, Cabet, had a chance to become the premier. But by that time, these idealists had already decided and had set the plans in motion to come to America. And so they left, and they were promised some good land in Texas. Well, they got to Texas and found out it was utterly inhospitable. Most of their money was exhausted. But they learned that up the Mississippi, in the town of Nauvoo, there was a city standing vacant, having just been vacated by the Mormons who had left for Salt Lake City. So here was a whole town, a town which had a population of 15,000, larger than Chicago at the time, just standing empty, brick buildings to a large extent. So they went up the river and settled in Nauvoo, and for 7 years tried to show these pioneers of humanity, as they call themselves, what a humane society is. But the reason why their commune failed was basically poor planning. There wasn't a member of the community who knew how to farm. They were artists, musicians, craftsmen. They developed an orchestra, they developed a glee club, they put on dramas. They had a magnificent library, but nobody knew how to make a living. So after 7 years, the thing virtually collapsed.
But with that, you can keep going for 7 years.
But they were able to keep going for 7 years. Well, you see, they could do it for 7 years. There's hope, Harold. They could do it for 7 years. But the reason was that the city was there. They didn't have to build a town or anything. See, the whole city was there. And the farmlands had been developed, and they couldn't even keep going what they had there. But when Cabet decided the only way to save the colony was for himself to become dictator, these independent, freedom-loving people couldn't stomach it, and they drove him out. And the colony split. Someone went down to St. Louis, someone went out to Corning, Iowa, and eventually they became wine growers out in the Napa Valley of California, for they disappeared early in the 20th century altogether. They were theists in their literature, but they claimed not to be Christian in their advertisements. But they did not have an economic base, and they did not have a religiously cohesive force, so it just fell apart. But it was a noble experiment in the fine craft of humane living. But one other one I'd like to refer to, and I saved this one till last because I think it's a little bit like Golden Village. And that is a group that goes back to the 11th century and continues to the present time with examples in the United States but also throughout the world. And that is the Cistercian Order of Roman Catholic Monks. The most famous of the Cistercian founders was Bernard of Clairvaux, who wrote that hymn that's so popular, I think, in Lutheran circles during Lent, "O Sacred Head Now Wounded." The Cistercian Order of Monks was one of the reform movements in Roman Catholic medieval monasticism that sought the simplicity of life by withdrawing to the inaccessible regions. And as one traces these through England, particularly in Yorkshire, because in England the monastic ruins still remain. There have been none of these devastating wars in England that you've had on the continent that have pretty well wiped out much of your monastic remains. But in England you can be driving along in the Yorkshire moors, and all of a sudden you'll come to a deep valley. And there on the valley floor are the remains of a Cistercian monastery. They went out into these inaccessible areas where they could live their disciplined, simple life, but also at the same time to bring that land under cultivation. And the Cistercians became the economic, agricultural pioneers of Europe. In the United States, they've done the same thing. Over in the bookstore, someone somewhere along the line has been very Cistercian, because there's a whole row of books by Thomas Merton, whose autobiography, Seven Story Mountain, is perhaps his most famous writing. Thomas Merton was a Cistercian monk living at Gethsemane in the wilderness of Kentucky. The two major Cistercian foundings in this country are Gethsemane in Kentucky in New Melloray, near Dubuque, Iowa. But what goes on in these monasteries? A little bit like what goes on here. At Vespers, or after Vespers, about every other night, someone shows slides of the seasons at Holden. If you go to Our Lady of New Melloray, the Cistercian monastery at Dubuque, and you ask to be introduced to their life, they take you into the audiovisual room. Two screens instead of our three. On one screen, you go through the change of season. On the other screen, you go through the daily life of the Cistercian monk, from matins in the morning until vespers at night. And they coordinate the two, daily life with the season. And what impresses me about the Cistercian utopianism is that is, while they plug into traditional Christianity, they have the Eucharist at certain times. Their basic interest is a nature mysticism. They're a poetic community. And they sense the fullness of life as they observe nature. Now, these Cistercians in Dubuque have 3,000 acres in the little Switzerland of Isle. Some of it's in corn, some of it's permanent pasture where they raise prize-winning beef, some of it is in forest. And I get their monthly newsletter, and it's a collection of poems as to how they understand their life in relationship to nature. And they draw their strength from nature. They go on their hikes. They look at the leaves. They're amazed by the snow in wintertime. They wait for the first frogs to start croaking in the spring. This is their utopia. However, they're not dependent upon volunteer gifts to keep their community going. They're economically self-sustaining with their beef and their corn. But it's a mysticism. But to become a part of this utopia is hard. There is a trial period. 14 years. 14 years of the novitiate. At any time during that period, you're free to leave. After that, you become a permanent part of the community. But there's a long, long testing. And also, you can't become a part of the community until you're at least 25. They do not want idealistic young people. They want people who have gone out from school, who have lived in the secular world, and then have decided, this is what we want to do. Their educational level is somewhat beyond that of the BA for the whole community. Highly educated group of men. But once you have made this mature decision, then you are a part of this poetic nature mysticism. And they have a very optimistic view of their life, and a very hopeful view of their future. But that too is a utopia. Well, what I'm just simply suggesting, and I haven't gone through all of them, but this is enough of them, that just located where I am, in the Quad Cities of Illinois and Iowa, going 50, 60 miles any direction, still in the 1970s, you have all of these utopias around you. Some of them are in ruins. Some of them are ongoing communities. Some of them are undergoing restorations. But this 19th century America of perfectionism and the freedom to be so has never really left the country. And it provides another religious alternative to the paternalistics and the primitivistics. Utopias, yes. We often say they die sooner rather than later. But some of these communities continue. And the people that are within them would never leave them. For they have found what they want to find in life, living with others of similar persuasion in these disciplined communities.
Was Brooks Farm, was that Unitarian or what?
Well, it had a religious base of a form of Unitarianism, but Unitarianism is a very difficult word to use because a Unitarian is defined by the individual, and there's really no community definition that one can give. You have Brooks Farm, you have Hopedale Farm, these that were all of short duration. You have the Oneidas that eventually became more known for its silver plate. So you had a lot of these on the East Coast in the 19th century, and many of them coming out of Concord, during that 5 years of literary giants there, particularly around Ralph Waldo Emerson, coming out of Concord. You had a number of them in long-developed Massachusetts. These weren't frontier communities at all. These came out of a very long-established colonial society. But they come about the same time, 1830s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, when they get started. See, right then, right before the Civil War, and I'd say the 20, 30 years before the Civil War, there seemed to be an environment in this country for the creation of so many of these.